Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tulsa Ballet opens its season this weekend with a triple bill of mixed repertoire, including the return of choreographer Edouard Liang's work in his best-known ballet, The Age of Innocence. But the evening also marks the debut of Britain's top choreographer for contemporary and modern dance when Tulsa Ballet presents the U.S. premiere of Wayne McGregor's Presentient. Wayne McGregor is my guest today. He is the artistic director of Random Dance, the resident company of the Sadler Wells Theatre in London, and resident choreographer at the historic Royal Ballet. His work is distinctive for his unique dance vocabulary, his ability to integrate film and visual art, and his interest in incorporation of computer technology and bioscience in his work. In fact, in 2004, he was a research fellow at Cambridge's Department of Experimental Psychology. McGregor regularly works with the biggest and greatest companies in the world, La Scala, Paris Opera, Netherlands Dance Theater, Stuttgart Ballet, New York City Ballet, San Francisco Ballet. This past summer, he premiered a major dance work in Trafalgar Square just prior to the London Olympics. Big Dance Trafalgar Square featured 900 dancers. He'll also be doing a special anniversary production for the Bolshoi Ballet of their 250th anniversary and the 100th anniversary when he sets The Rite of Spring in 2013. Wayne McGregor is my guest today. Tulsa Ballet presents Presentient Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Wayne McGregor, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We are certainly looking forward to Presentient when it opens this weekend. And I was really struck by something. I guess it's a central point of your philosophy. In an interview, you said, "I really believe in dance that's plugged into the real world." What do you mean by that?
Well, I guess I mean that I'm just very interested in dance being part of the wider debate about what's going on in the world. I feel that, you know, as a contemporary artist, I feel ballet is a contemporary art form and that one should be responding to contemporary issues, whatever they are, if they're in science or if they're in music or if they're in even in politics. And I think that's what's interesting for audiences, that they feel that what they're watching is something of their time.
Mm-hmm. And certainly your vocabulary is plugged into the real world. What I love about it, first of all, the speed of it is incredible. And I guess that's a trademark of yours. You believe in moving fast.
Well, I do. I speak fast and I move fast in life. But I think there's something about kind of the capability of the human body that's really extraordinary. And I think in daily life, we explore so little of it. You know, a very normalized way of moving, and we don't move that much and increasingly less and less. And I think this fantastic technological instrument they have, the most technologically literate thing that we have, the human body, is something to exploit and explore. And my job as a choreographer is to find new ways of making that body move and to challenge dancers to do complex coordinations quickly. And I think there's something thrilling for the eye when you see a body doing things that are unfamiliar. And I think that's something that engages your brain in a way that no other art form can.
Well, and certainly the look of what you're doing, it's not out of the classical ballet sense. It is, these are very much real-world movements, which I find interesting because I can see that there's this underpinning there of classical dance, but the movements are very different.
Well, I think what's interesting about classical dance, like any kind of classical art form, is something to work from. It's something to jump off from. And, you know, we know that there are fantastic tenets in classical ballet that are fantastic to see. And in training, you get these finely tuned instruments, which are classical dancers that can do extraordinary things. And I just think the combination of that kind of literacy in a body and then a body that's doing things that are unfamiliar is very interesting. It's very, very thrilling. And if you're able to stand on point and extend your leg in a particular way, in a classical way, you can also do that with a hip distortion, your head in a different way, and it makes you kind of understand the world differently. And I guess one of my pleasures in life is to try and subvert what people think that they know and also try and take them off into different directions.
One of the things I find interesting is the arm movements, because you could see in a different world they would be classical, but just the whole way your dancers present their arms, for example, is 21st century natural, and yet it's choreographed.
Yeah, no, it's all choreographed. I mean, I think I've got very long arms, so I've always been interested to see how I might be able to fracture the arm joints and kind of, you know, invert them and twist them and do different things with them. And I think, you know, often traditionally in classical ballet, there's a very particularity about how the arms work in relationship to the legs.
And it's very stiff.
And it's, you know, it can be stiff. I think what I've always been interested in is almost like separating the body and giving an organisation to the legs. It's very different from the arms, and see how the brain mashes those together to come up with a different type of behaviour. And I'm often doing things that are challenging the dancers to do one set of coordination on one set of the arms and something on the other. And that's as much mental work as it is physical work. But actually, it becomes a logic. The brain is very fast at organising the nature of the body. And over time, dancers are able to do that increasingly well. And that gives me more and more room to invent different types of language for all parts of the body that you wouldn't expect.
This is a really interesting time for dance, because dance is, in even the most conservative companies which you work with, like the Royal Ballet, it's been pretty staid. And in about the last generation, all of a sudden, these dance companies, some more tradition-bound than others, are opening themselves up to completely new ways of expressing themselves through dance. And I would think it would be really interesting, since you work with some, of, as well as your own company, these very traditional companies. What's it like working with dancers that are, you know, used to doing, you know, the classical war horses, 100 performances a year, and all of a sudden, okay, here we're going to do this completely different animal?
I mean, I think it's interesting that you say that, you know, organizations like the Royal Ballet are traditional or conservative in some way, because actually that's not been my experience of them. And I work a lot at the Royal Ballet, the Paris Opera, the Bolshoi, these places where actually a classical repertory is very much ingrained in the way in which they work. But we forget often that dance is a very young person's profession. And all of the dancers that I'm working with are actually probably 20, 25 years younger than me. And that they have been actually plugged into the real world in a way with computers and technology that actually of the past dancers of the past weren't. And so already they think differently.
So it's interesting, because the perception is of tradition, because you've lived a longer life, you've seen how these organizations have transformed, but the dancers who actually do the work are short and transitory.
Absolutely.
They don't have these memories.
Yeah, they don't have these memories. And not only that, they have a technicity in the body which is different from dancers of the past. They're more able. The training is better. The way in which we understand what kinds of foods we should eat to fuel the body in a different way helps us have this machine work in a different way. And all of those things allow you to extend the possibilities of what dance can be. And all I know is when I go into these fantastic places with beautiful theatres, is that the dancers that are in front of me are hungry for choreographers who are alive to be working with them. And although, you know, they absolutely love doing the classical repertory and they love interpreting roles, that's very different than having a role authored on you or working with a choreographer live in the space. And they want to be part, ultimately, of that kind of lineage of ballet, that ballet is a form which is an evolution. And I think that's what's really exciting about these often considered more traditional organisations, is that they're bringing live choreographers into work there to actually challenge their dancers and to take their rep off into different directions. And Monica Mason, who appointed me to be resident choreographer of the Royal Ballet, who'd been in the Royal Ballet for 55 years, that in some ways that was a very brave decision, but I think a very necessary one if, again, the ballet is going to have a life outside of a very small group of people that really love classical dance.
I would imagine the company welcomed you. What about audiences? I mean, are audiences as open as your dancers?
Well, you know, it's always a challenge with audiences. And it's you know, it's one thing for Covent Garden to be full, and it's another thing for Covent Garden to be full with lots of different types of people. And I think one of my tenets has been, as resident choreographer, is we've been looking and absolutely deliberately accessing an audience that don't normally come to ballet, and that's often a much younger audience, but not necessarily, or an audience that might be interested in visual arts, or an audience that comes with a very, very different filter. We all have ways of watching things. You know, we've got these kind of imbued implicit ways and references of watching things. And I think it's difficult for audiences to be genuinely open to new work. And one of the things we've tried to do in the work that we've done and the pre-work that we've done at Covent Garden and places like that is also kind of give the audience's eyes to see differently and to be confident in watching something with different filters. Classical ballet, narrative ballet, story ballet is fantastic. I love watching it myself. But it's just one way in which dance can communicate to audiences. And there are so many other thrilling ways. I think when audiences see it, they actually realize there's kind of endless possibility.
And with your work, it oftentimes involves film, it involves animation, it involves everything that the computer can bring to a stage production. That's very important to you.
Yeah, it's very important because I think, you know, the human body is the best interface to the world. And it's also, the human body is the interface to all technology. I can't work with any technology without in some way embodying it. You know, even if I'm working with my iPad or if I'm working online, there's a sense in which there's a physical dimension to all technology. And so it seems a very natural partner for work on stage, not only in terms of scenography, but also how actually dance is made.
Now, when you're working on an idea, a piece, where is the beginning point? Is it a physical movement? Is it a piece of music? Or is it a technology?
Well, it really depends. It really depends on the piece. I've been working for the last 10 years with a group of amazing cognitive scientists in both Cambridge and in San Diego, where actually what the starting points have been is actually what are the technicities of creativity? How is it that you become creative? What stimulates you to be creative? What are your jumping off points? So sometimes I work with science as a jumping off point. You know, I might work with a book. I recently made a piece about the Age of Enlightenment based on this book by Roy Porter called Flesh and the Age of Reason. Sometimes I might take an image. You know, in the case of Presentient, which is this ballad that I'm making, I've made and Tulsa are performing, it was more the music. It was a Steve Reichstor, fantastic, amazing
string quartet with two recorded quartets.
Yeah, and it's very visceral music, very complicated structurally. And I felt that was a challenge in itself, in a way I didn't need anything else. It propelled me, it made me think of images, it gave me a compulsion to move, and that's how I made it. So I think the starting points are often very diverse, and what I love to do is to be open to the world and to be open to where the kind of the stimulants might come from. And it might as well come from something which is quite unusual and unexpected as something that you might imagine dancers are made from.
Now, are you a techno geek yourself as far as...
I am a bit, yeah.
So you're looking for ways in which you can enhance your experience. Like, I know you've worked with animations where you have animations next to your dancers and you're using video as well. So you're looking for those opportunities to enhance what your dancers are doing.
Well, I think enhance or counterpoint or, you know, I think choreography is not just about what dancers on stage do. And I think choreographic principles can be applied to film and animation and 3D projection and lots of technologies. So you're still using your choreographic sensibilities or choreographic skills to work in those mediums. So it doesn't feel like a separate thing or an additional thing in that way. Also, I think for audiences, there's something interesting about this relationship between technology and the body, you know, the body expressed in lots of other forms. And for dance, that's very important, you know.
My guest today is Wayne McGregor. He is a choreographer for Tulsa Ballet as they present the U.S. premiere of his Presentient as part of a triple bill of mixed repertory. He is artistic director of Random Dance, his company, and that's the resident company of the Sadler Wells Theater in London, and the resident choreographer at the Royal Ballet as well. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you talk about taking these journeys together. In your wildest mind, did you think you would end up in Tulsa in one of your choreographic journeys?
Honestly, I didn't. I didn't imagine it particularly, but you know, you never know, right?
So how did the story, I mean, I know Marcello is great at, you know, unabashedly going to the great world's great choreographers and saying, come to Tulsa.
I think that's quite extraordinary in itself. I mean, I think, you know, Marcello is very persistent. And what I really loved and appreciated and actually respected about his approach to me was that he didn't just email me or just say, I've seen your stuff on video or online. He actually came to performances and asked to meet me, and we met in San Francisco. And he talked with such passion and kind of candor about his own company, about Tulsa Ballet. We've got an incredible rep for, you know, they've got incredible choreographers working, a very diverse rep. And he just asked me to come and have a look at the dancers, just to come and see. And I thought that was terrific. And because the approach was so personal and was so persistent, I thought, yeah, and I could see the passion in him, I came to Tulsa to see the dancers for myself.
And your reaction?
Well, they're doing a piece, so it must have been quite good. You know, I was thrilled. I mean, I saw a performance, and I thought that they had lots of physical kind of intelligences in their bodies and that they seemed to be able to deal with a range of repertory. And I tried to think of a piece that I thought would best suit them and challenge them and also give them hopefully new skills that they could take into other work.
And what is it about Presentient that is a good fit for Tulsa Ballet? And this is the first production in the United States, so it's never been on this side of the pond.
Well, I think one of the things is the use of weight is quite strange in Presentient. I made Presentient on an amazing dance company in London called Rombert. It's kind of more of a kind of a contemporary bent, if you like. And it's not in point shoes, it's in flat shoes. And so the weight is distributed in a very particular way. It's got quite complex partnering. It's an ensemble piece, so it's not like there's a star and, you know, a core around them. And I thought all of those things would actually work really well with this group of dancers. And actually, that's proved to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing is stars go to huge markets, but the core of this company is pretty darn competent.
Very good.
Yeah, very good. So what's the process for coming here and setting the ballet as far as you're usually in Europe for the most part? I think you come here to San Francisco occasionally and a few other select companies, but you're not here much.
No, I don't come. I mean, my company tour a lot in the States, but no, I don't come a lot. I mean, I came over to meet the dancers to have a look for myself, and then we did a casting. So you give dancers certain roles. And then my assistant Antoine Varikin, who's absolutely terrific, comes and restages it. So he spends 4 or 5 weeks with the dancers teaching the choreography. And then I come the last week and actually just hopefully give it a bit of magic, or just ask the dancers to think about things in a slightly different way. And that's what we've been doing the last couple of days. So I've had my first 2 sets of rehearsals with them.
Uh-huh. And what sort of different ways? I mean, do you want your dancers to have a feeling beyond, I've got to move here, move this? There's something at the base of their brain that is informing those movements.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's something about, I mean, I've been making choreography for 20 years, and so I've got a very particular way of looking at dancers, and I have a very particular way of being able to pull things out of dancers in terms of individual signatures. So I've always been interested with making dance and in dancers doing my work to not just impose the work on to a group of dancers, but actually to see how it fits them and then what they individually do with the work. So I have to see that for myself. So there's something about their personal physical signature that imbues itself on the work itself. And that's what I've been doing in the studio, is trying to marry those two things so that actually the rendition of the work is personal to the dancers of Tulsa Ballet, and they have the confidence and the, the confidence to be able to do it in that way.
I assume this is one of your speedy ballets?
It's quite fast, yeah. Well, that's thanks to Mr. Reich, actually. But it is very fast, and it's quite complicated to count. And also physically, it's very difficult. The body's moving often in lots of different directions at the same time. I think physically it can feel a little bit awkward, but there's something about the fluidity of action over time that I think is quite beguiling, and I think audiences find it quite thrilling to watch.
You mentioned counting, and I have a dumb question for you. That's, I know for a lot of your work, you're working with a lot of ambient music sometimes, which might involve drones and really a lack of a really strong pulse at times. How do dancers count ambient music where it is, you know, movement is measured in seconds rather than in beats?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think this is one of the wonderful things about the human body and the human body clock is that, you know, over time and when you train as a dancer, you start to get a kind of an innate sense of how long something should be. So I can look at something, a piece of choreography, and tell you pretty much within seconds how long it is. So if that phrase is 30 seconds or, you know, 40 seconds or a minute and a half, I pretty much can accurately tell you what it is. And there's just something about that ability to be able to understand your body in that way, that dancers over time can perform a solo exactly a minute, or they can absolutely do 40 seconds of this, 10 seconds of that, 13 seconds of this. And so there are lots of different ways in which we count. So we can count in terms of the counts of the music. We can count in second time. We can count, often I sing phrases. So you can have I might go, yeah. That gives you a sense of a rhythmic structure, which is very, as clear as
And there's
music.
Probably 7 movements in that.
Exactly.
In the seven syllables,
exactly.
Yeah.
It gives you a sense. It's a way of kind of using sonification to shape action, shape movement. So this is one way in which dancers remember. And I think that's one of the phenomenal things about dancers is their memory, because what they're doing is often they're learning lots of different languages at the same time. So they might be doing a classical language and they're doing a language of mine and they're doing a language of some other choreographers. And these are all very, very distinct and different languages. And dancers' facility to be able to remember is really extraordinary.
It really is when you think about it. If you could think of learning 3 foreign languages verbally, you know, at the same time, you're learning 3 vocabularies of movement in a triple bill like this particular
Absolutely.
One.
Absolutely. Having to go from the studio, you know, 35 minutes with this choreographer and then moving to the next one. So their, facility to change. You know, often we do dance a disservice by saying, oh, it's just a kind of an instinctive art form. It's not an intellectual art form. But actually, the engagement of the brain in dance is absolutely phenomenal. And what science researchers have been very curious about in the last kind of 10 years is actually how dancers and choreographers can help them understand functions of the brain better, because there are certain things about kinesthetic intelligence or physical intelligence that only dancers can do, or at least dancers are expert at. So there's something about physical thinking that we all do. We all physically think. You know, if I'm taking a lid off a jam jar, I might try and flip it first and then realise it needs a twist. I don't really think consciously about that. My body just does it. And that's an example, perhaps, of physical thinking. Dancers do that all of the time, every day, in many, many ways. And research scientists are finding that this is very useful information to mine for other aspects, and that those aspects in terms of rehabilitation of brain injury.
Yeah, right.
Lots of other kind of applications. Technologists are interested in terms of embodied technology. The Wii, for example, how can we actually have a more physicalized experience of playing games? Increasingly, computers are getting to a place where actually we want to have more embodied experiences with them. So this intelligence and this information is rich and it's important, and it's fantastic that we're able to share it.
I just, as you were talking, I had this vision of you doing your movements with a skull cap with wires coming off it. Have you done something like that?
I absolutely have, actually. I did one of the greatest things. I was born in the 70s, and I used to spend hours and hours programming my computer in the early 80s, actually. Yeah. Doing this thing called Pong, like a table tennis, and the bats would move up and down. But one great thing we did in San Diego is we wore a head sensor, and I was able to think up and move my bat up and think down and move my bat down and play table tennis with my partner, but thinking physically. And this is extraordinary. So this again has amazing application. This is happening. This is not like science fiction.
What a cool experience.
Cool, very cool. Yeah.
Now, is that something you can relate to choreography? Just the idea of this whole idea of, you know, I'm thinking and I'm seeing movement from these brain researchers. Is that something you can relate to choreography?
I think definitely, because I think we so often forget what our internal kind of imagination is doing. You know, not only have we got images in our head, we've got this constant narrative, you know, we've got this constant voice. You know,
and usually it's two or three.
You know, yeah, sometimes more, yeah. You know, and so when I'm making a decision about choreography, I'm not just making it and moving on. I've got this narrative that's commenting on it, and when, sometimes it comments as the critic, and sometimes it comments as, you know, as a taste arbiter. And part of choreography is about, in some way, holding on to those voices or encouraging those voices to think differently. And I think all of these things in relation to what's going on in the head is very useful to understand, to give us techniques and be in order to be able to work in a slightly different way in the studio. And that's what we've been doing with the dancers in working with cognitive scientists, that we're starting to understand how we think. And by understanding how we think in a creative situation, could we start to think differently? We've all got ingrained ways of thinking.
Talking about the critic and the taste arbiter, you know, those voices are certainly in there in any sort of creative act. There's also sort of a way of, okay, let's not listen to you guys right now.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no,
you have to tune those out.
You have to tune them out. Yeah, it's important to tune them out. And it's, you know, I notice a lot with young choreographers that that's one of their big preoccupations. So it's not actually.
It's got to be perfect from the start.
It's got to be perfect from the start. Yeah. They're not going to take the risk. They're not going to, you know, and one of the things that we do a lot when we're working on choreographic mentoring is analyzing a little bit about what are those voices in the head? What are, you know, how are you making your decisions? Are you genuinely making them because you want them to be like that, or because you think that might get you a commission in another company? Yeah. And this is very important, you know, for people to find their own voice and a voice which is really kind of singular or of their own time.
Wayne McGregor certainly has his own voice, and you'll be able to see his work in the U.S. premiere of Presentient. Tulsa Ballet presents his work for the very first time in a triple bill of mixed repertory this weekend at the Performing Arts Center. In our remaining time, I want to talk a little bit about some of your big things you've been doing.
Sure.
You had a big, it's like a flash mob, except it was a choreographed show in Trafalgar Square that sort of mimed a flash mob. And in many ways, 900 dancers in Trafalgar Square about a week or two before the Olympics. And an incredible array of people, young, obviously fit, some less than fit, some physically challenged, old, young, doing this wonderful piece out on Trafalgar Square. And you know, seeing the complexity of your work, it was really interesting to see that complexity boiled down to a really beautiful simplicity.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I mean, you're, you know, miming running, miming gymnastic poses. Mm. You know, it was just a really wonderful, piece, but 900 people.
Yeah. Well, it was 900 people. I mean, we all have a body, yeah, so we can all dance. That's my philosophy. But also, we can teach choreographic principles to people. And what was amazing about those 900 people is that they made their own choreography. I helped them make it, but they made their own language, they made their own choices, and I structured it. And so, you know, a flash mob is usually very short. This was a 45-minute choreographed piece in Trafalgar Square, and it came from them authoring their own work. And I think it's very powerful when you get a group of people from all walks of life who just want to have a go, want to just try and be creative and do something with the body that they've got. That's really moving and empowering, and that's very much what we wanted to do in the spirit of the Olympics for London.
You know, I would think you've probably took a great deal of enjoyment from the Games, talking about how you think of the body. And you're seeing, you know, Usain Bolt and these incredible gymnasts and people really taking their body to the outer limits.
Incredible. And I've had even more thrilling opportunity to see a lot of the Paralympics, which have been absolutely extraordinary. Because, again, you've got these unbelievable athletes with bodies that behave differently, doing the most extraordinary
guys without
things.
Arms who can win a gold medal in archery with his feet.
I think it just gives you so much inspiration and hope, and that, you know, hopefully gets people off their sofa and watching TV. You know, there's a sense in which if you can actually do something with your body, it's not only good for you, it gives you so much pleasure.
Well, from 900 dancers this summer, this next summer, you'll be doing a major premiere of The Rite of Spring with the Bolshoi. Well, I guess 900 will help you work down to what, 150, 200?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, they've got about 250 dancers at the Bolshoi, so I've got a big choice.
Yeah. You're doing The Rite of Spring, which will be the 100th anniversary of the premiere. And it's, what, another anniversary for the Bolshoi.
Yeah, 250 years of the Bolshoi, all on this one day, this premiere day.
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite a lot of pressure, actually.
That's a 8, 9, 10 months away, I suppose.
Yeah.
Are you already sitting with the Rite of Spring?
Or? Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been planning it and working on it for about 3 years. So typically, I work very far in advance, and I really like to get to know the music very well. And that we've designed it. You know, I've worked with the Bolshoi before, so it's a long process. And of course, it's different because, you know, I'm used to authoring brand new work with new authors and new people, and this is a piece that's so in the canon of both musical kind of literacy and dance literacy. So there's lots of versions of Rite of Spring too that you've got to kind of, like, you know, understand. Some of them that I absolutely love and think can't be bettered, like the Pina Bausch version in that way. So I've been thinking, how am I going to treat that? How am I going to do it differently? How am I going to do my own kind of 21st century response to it? And that's what we're thinking about.
How many Rites of Spring would you count as perhaps some influence on you? I mean, you mentioned the Bausch version.
Yeah, well, I mean, I love the Bausch version, but I mean, there are so many. You know, there's some really interesting ones by very modern choreographers, like Shen Wei has done a great Rite of Spring. Javier de Frutos has done a great Rite of Spring. You know, there's the traditional Beja one. We've got one in London by Kenneth McMillan, which is extraordinary. You know, there are absolutely lots of really interesting aspects, and they take very different points of view to this score. But I have to try and find my own way that is relevant today, you know. If the Rite of Spring is 100 years old, what can we say about it now? What does it mean to us now? And that's something that is the challenge of this work.
And is that something you've done, where you've taken, like, existing pieces of balletic music, existing piece, you know, again, the history of choreography, history of music together to create a new work?
No, this is the first time I've worked like that.
What an exciting challenge.
And I think, you know, it was an exciting challenge because it was the Bolshoi asking me to do the Rite of Spring, and so the provocation was so great, and I was so fearful of it that I thought I had to face it.
Now, see, this is another company I think of as being very tradition-bound, and I assume they're welcoming contemporary choreographers.
Well, what's been amazing, that they did a ballet of mine a year ago called Chroma, which won the Golden Mask Award.
Incredible ballet,
and
too.
And they were incredible in it. And what was amazing is I had so many of the old coaches who were in their 90s come up to me and kind of congratulate me and say how wonderful they thought the ballet was, because they could see its lineage. They could see where it, you know, its origin. And they loved that the art form was communicating to a younger audience, and they loved that it was developing and it was going to stay alive. And so, again, that gave me great heart. And what I've loved about working at the Bolshoi is that you have these amazing kind of theatrical workshops where they do costumes and set building and all of that, and you see the tradition is absolutely there. But actually, you've got the willingness, again, in front of you, the dancers, these young 20-year-olds who could do absolutely anything, who want to be in there working with live, real choreographers.
Now, are you working with those tradition-bound departments like costumes and sets and things like that?
We are working with them. We're challenging them to do things, again, slightly differently, but they absolutely, we want to work with these fantastic artisans.
Oh, it sounds like it's a great day. And when's the big premiere?
The premiere is in, gosh, I just a blank there. The premiere is in the end of March. It's March the 28th.
All right. Well, in the meantime, we're looking forward to seeing your work on Tassel Ballet Dancers and Precentient this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Wayne McGregor, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining
us. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Choreographer Wayne McGregor speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Tulsa Ballet presents the U.S. premiere of his Precentient as part of a triple bill of mixed repertory this weekend, Friday and Saturday and Sunday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Ticket information available at 918-596-7111. Well, we're going to leave you with a little music from Precentient. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.